From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Dawn Wells is my guest. For three seasons on CBS and for an eternity in reruns, Dawn Wells was Marianne on Gilligan's Island. She's also a former Miss Nevada and has appeared in tons of television shows and movies and nightclubs and stage shows and cartoon shows, too. She's one of the great beauties of our time and has now shared some of her winning philosophy and advice in a book called What Would Marianne Do? A Guide to Life. Dawn Wells, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Are you surprised, you know, considering all the things that have changed in the world, that Gilligan's Island is still such a well-regarded program with so many fans?
Well, it's interesting because you sort of keep up with the fan level as you go. And I watched the say, I was mistreated as a child, or I was an outcast, or I was a misfit, and I would come home and watch the show, and I felt I belonged. So if you as a young person watching the show, that feeling in you, that transcends. You'll want your children to watch it. You'll want your grandchildren to look at it. He created something that was timeless, I think, truly timeless.
Well, it was a wonderful show, but you know, I mean, there were a lot of sitcoms that premiered in that season, and yet not that many are, and it didn't last, you know, for like 11 years. It was only on for three seasons, and yet, you know, it's still around. It's on DVD. It's on and reruns all every day.
We've never been off the air since 1964, and we're in 30 languages all over the world.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Well, but there's no cars or clothes or anything that tell you when it was filmed. So if you're a new crop of kids, you think it's happening for the first time.
Oh.
Smart Sherwood Schwartz.
So I guess he was brilliant.
I guess so. I wish he'd have shared some of the finances with us, but he didn't, unfortunately.
You did, when you made your deal, there was no residuals at all, or 10 showings or something?
Oh, I mean, I think we got paid for 3 episodes or something, but I did a thing for CBS years ago, TV Moguls.
Uh-huh.
Reading my script, and it said that Sherwood Schwartz made $90 million on the Gilligan's Island reruns alone.
Wow.
And that's not Brady Bunch. It's not the regular productions. I thought he could have split a million between the 7 of us. But then again, that wasn't on the contract, so there we go.
Well, in the show, was there a kind of a hierarchy among the cast? Bob Denver had been a star already. He was in Dobie Gillis as Maynard G. Krebs, and of course Jim Backus was a huge star. Had been in many movies like Rebel Without a Cause long before Gilligan's Island. So, and you were just in the first season, you were just and the rest.
They didn't,
didn't even mention you. But among the cast, was there a hierarchy of people?
Well, no, I would say probably the hierarchy was Bob.
Yeah.
Because he was never a star. I mean, you never got that feeling from him. I think everybody was a hard worker. There were 7 of us, pretty equal in the scripts except for Bob and Alan, and nobody put their weight around. I was sort of in awe. I had done a lot of television for Warner Brothers, but I was very much in awe of Ginger being a movie star and watching what she looked like and how she handled herself. And I was very aware that Jim Backus shared his humor. He'd say, it'd be funnier if you try it this way or do it this way. He and Natalie used to kind of compete for exiting the scenes. And everybody was really, I guess, there for the whole, you know, trying to make the whole thing work. There wasn't any real star stuff going on.
You filmed the show indoors on a soundstage?
Well, and they built a lagoon on the outside where we would go out a couple of days a week, where a boat could come in and out, and there were palm trees that were in buckets, of course. And then I love this part. There were palm trees in buckets and orchids, and then we'd leave the set, and next thing, Gunsmoke would come in and put in pine trees and tumbleweed.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's a little different than changing a living room into a bedroom, isn't it?
I guess there was a kind of a feeling about the show. I mean, it's kind of like unreal. I mean, they didn't, you know, shoot for realism.
Oh, gosh, no. We would never get off the island. You know, how silly is that? It was kind of a fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think everybody's fantasy is, what would I be doing if I were on that island?
So how did you get cast in the part? I know you had done, well, you were a beauty pageant contestant, and you had done a lot of TV. You were on Maverick and Shy, a lot of Westerns, right?
Well, and I don't consider a beauty pageant. I didn't even mention it because so many people are beauty queens and come in and wanted to be in Hollywood. I was a chemistry major to begin with, and I became a theater major and said, I'll give myself 2 years, and if I don't go to work right away, I'm coming back to college, because I didn't have the dreams of being a movie star. But I looked at the both coasts, New York and Los Angeles, and New York, everybody could sing and dance, and I don't do either one. So I thought, all right, I'll give myself 2 years in Los Angeles and see if I go to work. And I went to work right away. I got my equity card with a play with Mercedes McCambridge and Leon Ames. And then because I was a perfect ingenue and very well trained, I remember Jack Warner calling my agent and saying, I actually had an intelligent conversation with this woman. I mean, because I was a college graduate and had some knowledge, I wasn't just a beauty queen. And when it came time to audition for this character, I went and met Sherwood Schwartz in his office, and we laughed and we talked and we quipped a little bit and came back, and then they decided there were three replacements. The pilot had three other characters in it, two school teachers and a professor or something. And they were replacing those three people. And my husband was an agent, but not mine. My agent was a very small agency. And when they started getting ready to test, they told my agent they weren't going to test me the first go around. They thought I was a little too smart to play Marianne. They'd test me the next time. And my husband said, test her now or don't test her. So they actually forced the test on me, but Ethel Winant from CBS liked me, and I knew the character. I knew what she would wear. I knew how she would be. And even though there were about 300 of us auditioning for all these roles, I wasn't nervous. I was very much at ease. The last day of the auditions, Raquel Welch came in to audition for Marianne, which she should have been a ginger, not a Marianne.
Right.
I was lucky in nobody, you know, once we went into production, everybody said, this isn't going to last 20 minutes. And, of course, here we are. So you never know, do you? You just can't tell.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were just kind of belittling the beauty pageant part of your career, but being in the Miss America pageant when you were in it, that was a big deal, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a big deal, but it was mainly more, it wasn't a beauty contest. They weren't in bikinis and all of that. It was the all-American girl, well-rounded, education, a talent, smart enough to answer some questions. It was a little different. I guess it was sort of the first of the first.
Yeah, right. But it was on TV, and Burt Parks was the host, and I remember all that.
Yeah, I was quite nervous about it, but you're so concentrating on the show that goes on television, you don't worry about your competition, really.
Yeah. What was your talent in the Miss America pageant?
Being from Shakespeare, I did As You Like It, where she's dressed as a boy talking to her boyfriend to see what he says about her.
Dressed as a boy? I don't think you were convincing at that, Don Wells.
Well, now, how do you know?
Well,
born yet. You wouldn't know what I'm talking about. No, you know, and all that Shakespeare in the tights and the hat and all that kind of stuff.
I bet you looked cute as a button.
Oh.
Well, hey, we're talking with Don Wells, and she's written a book, and it's called What Would Marianne Do? A Guide to Life, and it's a great book co-written with Steve Stinson. And the show, Gilligan's Island, of course, you know, people just love it, and it's such a marvelous show. And in your book, What Would Marianne Do?, you said that the character was like a blank slate when you became Marianne. How did you meet the challenge of creating a character there?
Like I said, when I auditioned, I sort of knew who she was and what she would be, and there was no description except she came from Kansas. So I think if you come from Kansas, you probably learned to milk a cow. You probably knew how to grow a vegetable. You probably pitched in. You weren't a little society girl with a $500 purse and all of that kind of stuff. So the basics of, and I was raised in Marianne. My mother raised me with Marianne values without even knowing it, even though I grew up in Reno, Nevada, where there was gambling and prostitution. My mother knew where I was every single minute up to the fact when I was 60 years old, she traced me to some airport in Sydney. My mother kept a real handle on me, and I wondered why I didn't run away, and why didn't I go out and get drunk, and why didn't I do all those things that kids are doing today. But I had respect for, and I think that it, nowadays the families are so mixed. There's stepchildren, and there's mixed religions, and there's mixed races, and everybody has to work to keep food on the table. It's not quite that same Donna Reed upbringing that I was brought up in. You know, I think it's much harder today. That's why I kind of thought with the book, the people will say to me, the fans will say, I was abused as a child. I used to come home and I was beaten, and the only show they'd let me watch was this one. And you see the sadness in some of the fans, and you think, you really had an influence. I really had an influence. I don't know what kind of an influence the Kardashians have at this point.
Well, exactly, sure.
It was different then.
Well, I enjoyed the show because I thought it was well crafted and funny.
Yes, it was funny. And Bob Denver was a genius with that physical comedy. The more I look at it, the more how he tripped and just fell and did all those things. That's a natural talent. It's like a Charlie Chaplin. You can't teach anybody that.
I always thought it was Laurel and Hardy with the skipper and
yes, it was.
Yeah, he definitely does. Alan Hale Jr. does a wonderful Oliver Hardy thing pretty much throughout the whole show.
And he was the size of my dad. And every time Alan would hug me, he'd pick me up about 4 feet off the floor, and you knew you were hugged.
Did you maintain a relationship with the other members of the cast?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, Natalie Schaefer and I were quite close. Bob Denver and I were very close, as was I with the professor and Alan. I think the two people that I related the least to, and it didn't mean I didn't relate, were basically Jim and Tina.
Hmm. So you and Tina were not like that? Was there some competition between you?
No, I don't think so. And that Ginger and Marianne question, I don't think even evolved till after we went off the air.
Yeah.
I was in awe. I mean, she was a movie star. She was beautiful, and I was watching everything that she did. She got us our false eyelashes. They were made of mink from New York, and she knew that the left side was the prettiest side of her face, although both of them are beautiful. But I was in awe, but very confident as an actress and where I fit. There was never any animosity. I never saw a temper tantrum. I never saw any of that. It was, I think, that read in the scripts, the way we all got along.
Yeah. Well, since you had kind of created your own character, if the writers came up with something that you thought was inconsistent, would you say to them, "Oh no, Marianne wouldn't do that," or "That's not right"?
Oh, sure, I would have, but I never saw it.
Oh, uh-huh.
No, I mean they knew who we were.
One of my favorite episodes is there's a beauty pageant on the island, and they're going to choose which is the most beautiful castaway, Miss Castaway. And there seemed like there might have been a hint of romance between Marianne and the professor in that episode.
And I just wondered in the world, we didn't dare touch that with a 10-foot pole. But we used to laugh and say, if we hadn't been married, I don't know, Marianne and the professor might have run off together.
Run off to a desert island.
Yes, on our own. I could have cooked, he could have gotten telescopes, we might have been there forever.
And you've done so many things as an actress, both before and after Gilligan's Island, but you still feel this a connection with Marianne.
Well, you know, she made me famous, so to speak. I mean, I could have done a million Shakespeare roles and things around the country that you might never have known who I was, so it kind of put me in front of the public. It upped my price a little bit, and it also gave me a challenge because people would say, "Are you kidding? Marianne playing that role? No way." I mean, it took me 2 years to even get him to let me do vagina monologues. So it was a curse and a blessing at the same time. That's why I went back to the stage, so I wouldn't be just typed. Of course, I couldn't play Marianne now in a million years. But still, you know, you kind of try to break that image a little bit to show that you can do more than just that character.
We're all shocked that Marianne knows the word vagina to begin with.
Oh, that's right.
Well, but you actually played
the cows and sheep on the farm. She knows about that stuff.
You actually played Mrs. Howell recently, too. Is that
yes,
right?
I did in the musical, and boy, it was really funny. I'll tell you a story. I don't sing. And I said to the director, "Well, Mrs. Howell doesn't sing." "Oh, yes, she does." I said, "No, she doesn't. She would talk these words." "No, she doesn't." So there was one little cute song, "Oh, it's good to be richer, it's better to be richest," or something. But then there's a love song at the end of the musical with she and Thurston. That's quite a lovely ballad. Well, believe me, I had a hard time with it. And I remember closing night, Barry Williams and I are dancing cheek to cheek, and he's going, he's humming trying to give me the note while I'm singing in my ear because I was so off key.
I don't believe you, but it's possible.
It's true. You should hear me. He's a jolly good fellow. In the first episode, Sherwood said, "Please just keep still. You are getting everybody off key." And I did a movie called Winter Hawk that I was very proud of, and I was playing a missionary. And the director said, "Now, you're going to lead the rest of the congregation in Amazing Grace." I said, "No, Charlie, I can't." He said, "Yes, of course you can." So he started me, he said, "You're right, you can't." And it was, you know, taking place in the 1850s, and I had this long skirt on. So we're in the middle of a field. He asked me to spread my legs about 2 feet. He puts a girl underneath me, between my legs, puts my skirt over her head. I mouth the words, and she's singing Amazing Grace.
Now I have to watch for that scene. That's incredible. That's taking lip sync to a new...
That's right, it is. We don't talk about that.
That's marvelous. Are there any plans for the 50th anniversary of Gilligan's Island?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. A couple of years ago, they talked about a movie, and those writers are gone, and that's out of the picture. I don't know. I would think that I produced a movie of the week for CBS. I would think since it was on CBS, they do some kind of a memorial or something, or they've talked about the film. But I've been in the midst of my book, and I haven't heard a word. I'm astounded. But, you know, making a movie out of something, it doesn't usually work, does it?
No. I mean, I don't like those movies that are – I don't care much for, I don't know, Bewitched or whatever.
You can't capture the chemistry.
No.
Get that Gilligan and the Skipper chemistry. You can't get – I just think that's almost impossible.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not possible. I mean, and you don't need to do it because the show is still in existence and every episode is available and they're all great. And just watch them again. That's what I say. That's how I'm going to celebrate.
I put my short shorts up for sale this year.
Oh.
I don't have any children, and I start thinking, my God, it's the 50th year. When I croak, they're going to say, where are they? So I thought, well, they were the first short shorts on television. I designed them. Couldn't show my navel.
Yeah, you said that you couldn't show your navel. Did they tell you that? No navels?
No navel, no cleavage. And Sherwood used to say, oh, I had such a hard day today. I had to go back to the set three times. You could see Marianne's navel when she was walking. Ginger's cleavage was showing. We were only allowed to show it for 30 seconds or something. I mean, it was quite a deal. And now think what's going on.
Really? now you can't have a show without a navel. You must have someone's navel in every...
If you aren't naked, they don't want you.
I wonder if Barbara Eden had that same edict.
Well, Barbara and I were very good friends at the time, and her waistband came up higher than my shorts. And I designed the shorts because I'm little, short. Yeah. My legs aren't very long, and Tina's legs are 6 feet tall. So I curved them up on the side of my legs, and I curved them down at the waist so my midriff would look longer, and then it just kind of scooped up over my navel and scooped down again.
Did you wear the same? You must have had more than one pair of shorts. There must have been dozens of pair.
Well, probably just two or three, because I was in that gingham dress a lot, too.
Yeah, oh, I love that.
Yeah. Where that is. Well, at least I had the shorts. I don't know how I got them home. I mean, we were picked up for the next season. We were going to go to Hawaii and shoot, and then they canceled Gunsmoke, and Mrs. Paley said, no, don't cancel it. So he put it back on and canceled us.
Oh.
Well, oh. I lost my father, got a divorce, and the series was canceled all in the same month.
Oh, my gosh. That was a bad month for you.
It was, but I don't know anything about tranquilizers, so I got through it.
I guess. But, you know, it wasn't truly the end because, like we've said, it's lasted. I have fond memories of a cartoon show you did where you played both Marianne and Ginger.
Gilligan's Planet, yeah. I would like to see the Gilligan's Island in a foreign language. It would really be interesting to see it in Japanese or in French or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you'd do with a song. But it'd be fun to see all those little, however somebody would say it. I think it'd be fun.
It seemed to me, I mean, I was just a kid, but it seemed to me that you took that cartoon show seriously.
Oh, sure. Well, I was excited to do both voices, too.
Yeah. And you...
It
was kind of schizophrenic of you to be both...
Oh, yes. Do Ginger really well when the lights are low. No. I didn't say that. Mrs. Howell did.
Oh. Now let's talk about your book a little. What would Marianne do? You were saying in this book that you would like to just talk to everybody, but since you can't, you're talking to them through this book. And I don't want people to think it's a memoir exactly of your life, although that's part of it. But it's really an advice column.
Yes, and you being a male and having read it, I think it's a light read. I think it's kind of it makes some sense. It's kind of who I am. And how I was raised, and what I think I would be doing if I were a parent, and I think it's kind of something you share with your daughter or your son, or you give it as a Christmas gift to somebody who's not necessarily having trouble with their children. But today, both parents work. It's multiracial, multi families all trying to live together. It's not as easy. And if you've got a child that you've married a husband who has a daughter whose ex-wife doesn't believe in manners and she's eating with her fingers and you're sitting down at a table, there's going to be chaos to begin with. So how do we all make that work? And I think values and listening and back to the old ABCs, kindness and being polite and being the best you can be. One of my chapters, if you don't fail, fail, fail again. I mean, you don't just try once. What do you think these basketball players shoot? And if they don't make a basket, that's the end of it. So I think we need to kind of revive that in our youth a little bit. It isn't just $500 purses and red carpet. There's a lot more to who you're going to be 10 years later. And I was hoping that maybe that book would instill some of that without preaching.
Well, it does that. And you also talk a bit about beauty, and you're a very beautiful woman, and you're still an incredibly beautiful woman based on these pictures that I'm looking at. And
well, thank you for that, but it's all paint. I mean, there's a little natural bone structure, but not a lot. But you need to learn, if you're a young lady, you need to learn what your best features and what you're grooming. And clean hair is always the best, and nails that aren't dirty, and find out what's the most becoming to you. I went to Rush's every single day, which means I went and saw what they filmed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Analyze that. No, that's not a good color on me. No, that's the wrong hairdo on me. Like I was a package that I was selling rather than, well, I'd rather wear that. And I'm still very aware of that, what's the most flattering. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean vanity that that's all you're thinking about, but we should be the best we can be in everything we do, in our study habits, in our looks, in our relationship with people. I mean, I think that the world would be a better place if we all were the best we were.
You talk a bit about friendship and about choosing your friends, and you make a correlation between, you know, being stuck on an island with so many people, as in Gilligan's Island, and in choosing your friends. You want to talk about that a little?
Well, I do, and I've had friends from high school that I've known since first grade. We're still close. I went to a women's college in Missouri where two of my very closest friends, we met when we were 17. I believe that the core of you goes on if you're there for the right reason. If you're there to make a splash or have to be with somebody rich or have to be invited to these things and that things, there's no stability inside of you. And I was really raised by a good mother. I really was. And my parents were divorced. And my mother and father were friends, and my mother and stepmother were friends, and I just had two families that loved me. I am blessed with that. I get so many fans that say I was just so mistreated, and you were my only family, and that breaks my heart, because it isn't easy today. But if there's love in that household and respect for each other, you'd be surprised how you turn out.
Was not having children yourself just something that happened? Did you want to have children?
Of course I wanted to have children, and I couldn't do it while I was shooting the series. That wasn't an issue until the series was over. And then I got a divorce, and I certainly wasn't going to have a baby not married. I moved to Nashville. I fell in love with someone. I moved to Nashville, but we didn't live together. I don't believe in that unless you're married. But I helped raise his children, and I'm very proud of how they turned out. And my father and stepmother adopted two children when I was 14 and 15, and they lost him when they were just in high school, so I helped raise them as well. So I've been a mother, so to speak, from afar, but I know, I recognize a good one when I see one. I have a friend in Nashville who's the best mother in the world, and I can see that. So I didn't get a chance to do it myself, but children have always been a part of my life.
And now you're mothering us all with this wonderful book. It's called What Would Marianne Do? A Guide to Life. There's a lot of good advice and philosophy in this book, as well as some fabulous pictures of you and your career and a bit of memoir, too. And I hope the book is a big success, and I want to thank you so much, Dawn Wells, for sharing some time with us here on From the Bookshelf.
Well, and I'm so delighted that a man is finding the book appealing as well. I appreciate that.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour. A three-hour tour. The weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost. The minnow would be lost. The ship's aground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too. The millionaire and his wife, the movie star, the professor and Mary Ann, here on Gilligan's Isle.
Well, Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, the lovely Dawn Wells. Her new book is called What Would Marianne Do? A Guide to Life. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.